Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org. So, the four vows, and welcome visitors, thanks for coming in, dropping in. We're talking about the four vows this weekend. Yesterday I talked about the first vow. And Tore here indicates, I think, that the first vow comes first because compassion comes first, he says. Recently I saw the word compassion translated as care. That care comes first. So the first one sets the frame for our practice, as the reason we're doing it is not just for ourselves. It's not just as great as the mindfulness movement is, it's brought this kind of meditation all around the world. It's not just to make us better, more productive. It's not just to not just to make us happy, though it may do both of those things. I hope it does. It's really to help others, and in some way to help the whole world. It sets the frame big, that we're involved in a big project here, not small. And that can overwhelm you. How can you not be overwhelmed by these four great vows? Try not to be. Take it as a spirit, as a direction, rather than literally. But it's teed up at first. We're involved in something big, and it's about more than just you or me. Someone recently told me, a practitioner, that when it got to be about others for her, when she realized that, practice got a lot more interesting. And I think that's true. So, though it seems like maybe you could make an argument for this one being last, do all your practice first and then save all beings and then liberate everybody. It comes first. So, like I say, to set the frame as big, we practice for everyone. Second precept today. Today we're going to look at just the second precept, our unwholesome passions. Bon-no in the, when we're going through the four great vows in Japanese, literally means the afflictions or distresses. But that's the way they translated the original Sanskrit word, which is klesha, some of you may remember from that Roots of Buddhism class. The kleshas are known sometimes as the poisons, three poisons. There are unwholesome tendencies. And in Buddhism, they're seen as the root of a lot of our troubles. We translate them here as greed, hatred, and ignorance. And they're often represented by a rooster, who's greed, and a snake, who's hatred, or anger sometimes translated, and a pig, who's ignorance. They didn't know in those days how smart pigs really were. So here's a picture. Can you see it way back there? Yeah. Looks great, doesn't it? And in the very middle, look carefully, very middle there, Wes, you can see it. I'm going to pass this around. Just take my word for it for now. Here we have a snake, a pig, and a rooster. Right in the middle of everything. And you know what these are? Somebody tell me. You know, you've seen this picture before. They're six, divided into six. Six regions. Six realms. Those are the six realms. And and this over here, this is, I think he's got a bunch of skulls up here, so I'm guessing that's the shadow of death, you know, around it. And this is the six realms of rebirth. We're going to be reborn. You are going to be reborn into one of those realms, according to the old school, next time around. And, you know, they're full of trouble, the realms, even the top ones. You know, heaven, everybody's too slothful to practice. Next one down, the realm of the devas. They're jealous, angry that they weren't born in the realm above. So they just bicker with each other all the time. Yeah, it's trouble. The human realm is actually the best one because it's just in between the lower realms and the higher realms. So there's enough suffering to know that we should practice, and there's enough. There's enough ease that we can practice. So, yeah. One other thing about this is that, let's see. Okay, so these three, you'll notice when you take a look at it, they have each other's tail. They're biting. So they're all interconnected. They can't give each other up. And take a look for this too. You like this, Joni? There's a Buddha in every realm. So it's a little bit like Where's Waldo. You have to look very carefully. There's a Buddha in every realm, surrounded by a little bubble. Look for the bubble. So in every realm there's a Buddha. I'll pass that around. And those kleshas are what are the hub of the wheel that keeps that wheel of rebirth going round and round and round. So, yeah, and you can see this, as many did, maybe do, as a cosmic truth. The truth of the way things are, of the wheel of rebirth, it predates Buddhism, in fact, that idea. Or you can see it as a personal truth, that this is the way things are for us, that that we're driven. You know, and I would add that, would argue that by such basic forces as evolution, by impulses that can be harmful, that can get out of control in unwholesome ways, that is a core drive that we have. And also that we're shadowed by death. You know, in the background, all of the time, that we're the only animals that we know of, the only creatures that know that we will die. We know that that shadow is there always, and we, all of us, regularly visit all of these realms, all six of these realms. We know them; they're marked by sloth or arrogance or jealousy or greed or ease, some of them care. And there's a Buddha in each one. In all of these states, the Buddha is nearby. Whether we feel that presence or not, even in hell, even in the hell realm, and in the hungry gross realm, which is marked by greed, there the Buddha is. Right there. That's something to remember during a retreat, too. Even when you're feeling at your lowest point, in fact, sometimes, especially when you're feeling at your lowest point, the Buddha is right there. If you care to look. So that's part of our practice, is to look in all states, to look for the Buddha. See if we can feel that Buddha nature within us. So the story of that, I think, one of the stories, is that the Buddha is always nearby, no matter how lonely or anguished or tired we are. And this vow, this second vow, says we're going to work with these energies, these difficult energies. We're going to take a look at them and work with them. And if possible, as we translate them in our Sangha, transform them. So I'm just going to take there's three of them, right? Greed, hatred, ignorance. I'm going to take greed and hatred first. Those are a pair. They're opposites. They're related opposites. And they are unwholesome, you could say maybe grotesque even, extensions of something much more basic, of liking and disliking. Greed is liking that went off the rails. Hatred is disliking that went off the rails. That goes to an unwholesome extent or degree. Those are the basic energies. And so the basic energies could... the Buddha calls, and he does this often. He really often mentions this if you read the old texts, attraction and aversion. He's really interested in those two energies and taking a look at them, noticing the way they come up. It's cold in here, right? Mm-hmm. Is it cold? Mm-hmm. You want to turn it up just a little? You know, we've got guests. Not for me. Not for me. I'm fine. I don't have any desires. So attraction and aversion, liking or disliking, which is the very root of deciding whether something is good or bad. So, and the Buddha says, really work with those. It's subtle work to feel even a slight attraction toward things or a slight aversion toward them. And as I said, that's the beginning of making something good or bad. And of course, you can notice that during a retreat too. You know, you hear a noise that you don't like, somebody breathing hard next to you, or, a chainsaw outside, or you have a slight not good feeling about this food or that food, just to feel it, you know, and then to question how fundamentally good or bad is that. Somebody has a whistle in their nose. That can be annoying. Or you have a whistle in your nose. That can really be annoying. Can you just take it in a neutral way? It is possible, and it's very good practice to get to really question, what is it that I'm just assuming is bad? What is it really? And I think our core practice of Zazen is getting beyond or underneath, or maybe you could say before the attraction and aversion happen. We're getting to a place that predates that. Before, as the third ancestor said, he says, the great way is not difficult for those who do not pick and choose. Before, we're picking and choosing. Just don't pick and choose. Just don't have preference over this or that. Just. That's a long just. But that is our practice, is to feel what it's like not to have a preference about something, about anything. Okay. This comes, that comes. Too cold, too warm. And so, though there are many ways to get to quiet, I've talked about breathing, we often say, drop your need to think. Another way to into quiet, one that I use sometimes, is to follow this thread of not picking and choosing, and of not wanting anything, not desiring anything at all. Not wanting it to be more or less comfortable in your body. Just not wanting. Not wanting to fix anything in your life to go a step further. Not needing to figure anything out. We have so much to figure out. We have so much to think about, so many problems to worry about. See if you can feel what it's like just to let your life be a mess. And just to sit in the middle of that mess. Broken, just fine. I'll leave it aside. And that, then, if we can do that, we will find a truly quiet place. A place that does not have, as my teacher said, that does not have any will or desire. And that's a feeling of deep okay with things just as they are, as the Buddha said, things thus. And that we call nirvana. And it's before likes, it's before dislikes, it's before we make up good or bad. By the way, I should say, we need good and bad. We need likes and dislikes in our world. We will have them. They're fine. The thing that I'm saying is not scotch all of that permanently. I'm saying scotch all of it temporarily. Find another place to rest. That will change the way you hold on to likes and dislikes. That will change the way you work with good and bad in a way that can be very useful and helpful. So that place of no good or bad, that's the Garden of Eden before anybody ate of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And it's a pleasant place to be. And God's right there. And he's not at all angry. So we work with greed and hatred. Sometimes translated as anger, as a kind of strong, unhealthy wanting or a strong, unhealthy aversion. And one way we work with that is to get to a place without any attraction or aversion, without any desire at all. And knowing that place, knowing that that place is with us always, knowing that Buddha is with us, has an effect on our character. when we come back, we don't, it's easier for us to not grasp at things in the same way, or shove them away in the same way. We have it, just as I said with the whistle in your nose, you begin to question your previously unquestioned assumptions about things. So knowing that the Buddha is in every realm has an effect. And has an effect in particular, now I'm talking about, with greed and hatred. Has a calming effect and a questioning effect. And then there's ignorance. And the root ignorance in Buddhism is the ignorance that there is this aspect of yourself that is a Buddha, that there is Buddha nature, that there is a place that doesn't need good or bad, and that can be fully at peace. That is an unusual idea, you know, for general folks, I think. So that's the root ignorance. Ignorance of Buddha nature. And you know, in one legend, the Buddha, right after his awakening, said, all beings are already enlightened. They just don't see it. That's the root ignorance. Everybody already has it. They just don't see it. That's what Hui Ning's point was. You already have it. You just need to see it. In the with the poem, and that was also when I started my practice. That one of the first things read to me, a sheet of paper, on behalf of the Roshi, was, "Please start your practice with faith." What? With faith that you have Buddha nature, and that you share that nature with every tree and flower. And that if you were to meet God and the devil, they also would have Buddha nature together with you. That's it. You've already got it. You just have to find it. The just part is again, it's long. You just have to find it. But that's the ignorance part. That's the idea that it's really just the problem of ignorance. It's just a problem of seeing. The thing is, to see it, we've got to go through all these things. And one of the things that we can go through, I think we really need to go through, is finding this place of no desire, in order to really find it and feel it and stand on it. So these, Karen Armstrong, who writes the biography of the Buddha, says that these two roots, on the one hand, the desire, so for something or against something, craving on the one side, and ignorance, have been around from the beginning, from before the Buddha. There was this idea that, well, is it ignorance that's the problem? Or is it craving that's the problem? And she said, the ignorance guys set up camp on one side of the Ganges, and the desire crowd was on the other side of the Ganges. And the Buddha, he started with the ignorant side. and he found it didn't work for him. There was a lot of study involved on that side at that time. And so he flipped over to the other side of the Ganges and joined the desire guys. Now, they were bodily, right? They weren't so much head. They were working with their bodies. And remember all those austerities they went through, eating one grain of rice a day and getting so thin that his belly button touched his backbone? That was when he was working with those guys. But he realized at some point that this is not working either. This is too much. And he sat down and somebody offered him a bowl of porridge and he ate it. And his friend said, "Jesus, this guy's gone all soft. He's not really investigating anymore." But the Buddha said, "To heck with you." And he ate it and he sat under the tree. And there is this one, now I'm really spinning off, but I just remembered, there is this one story that he said to have remembered at that moment that he eats the porridge. Do you know that story? It's the story of the rose apple tree. I'm not going to go into it deeply, but it's relevant because he has, as he eats that porridge, he has this memory all of a sudden that when he was a kid, you know, his mother died and he was taken care of by various people. And so a nanny was looking after him at the fall harvest festival. And she left him under the rose apple tree. And he, while he was sitting there, he just, for the first time, just decided, you know, there was nothing to do. I don't know if it hadn't started yet or what. And he just sat zazen for the first time. And then he noticed in the plow that had come by some spiders and spiders' eggs that had been killed. And he had this deep feeling of loss and sorrow, and he just kept sitting. And he felt calm and good. And even though the sun moved, went all the way over to the shadow stayed right over. The shadow of the rose apple tree stayed right over to give him comfort. And the Buddha remembered, had this memory that, oh, I did this before. I felt this, I felt it before when I was a kid. Which to me is that ignorant side, you see. Oh, I've got this already. That's what that story says. It's already there. This knowledge is already there. I don't have to try so hard. It comes from way back. So those two, those desire in the form of attraction or in the form of greed and hatred and ignorance. There's more to be said about that. Well, one more thing to say about that, which is that the Buddha actually plants both of them as causes in his theology. The desire in the four great vow, in the four noble truths, the cause of suffering is craving. And then the way to get over that is to give up craving. And in the 12-fold chain of causation, the very root one is ignorance. The thing that begins it all is ignorance. So it's both, they're both there. So the second vow says that these things keep coming up, you know, and we have to keep working on them. We have to keep working with them. And though knowing the address of the Garden of Eden helps, and knowing that there's a Buddha in every realm helps, and it really I think it helps a great deal. I also think it's not enough. We have to work to integrate that knowledge, that feeling into our lives so that it helps us and helps everybody else, all sentient beings. I love butter. I love it so much. I'm really quite attached to it. And it's not my fault. it's my mother's fault because I inherited it from her. When we have you know, Thanksgiving or something together, both of us have just as much butter as mashed potatoes. And so it was probably made worse by Mount Baldy, because at Mount Baldy there was not much, you know, fat in the diet. And when butter would come around, or cheese, I think most of the monks and nuns just lathered it on. And so, yeah, usually that's fine. It works out. And I'm usually fairly unapologetic about it. I don't think it's hurting that many people. But in Norway, we do sesshin out in the woods, and we bring all the provisions in. And this has happened twice now, I think, during sesshin, where an announcement is made to the officers by the tenzo that we're running out of butter. And I've got to tell you, I've been practicing for a long time, and that is hard for me. It comes to me first, you know, in the line. So I don't know. I had this whole conversation about, you know, well, I don't know. Are they going to use much butter down there? Really? Those guys, they don't look like... I bet they don't like butter as much as I like butter. Just thinking, trying to think neutrally. Anyway, it's hard. So I really feel greed at that moment. I really feel it. It comes up strong. I should just hold back, but I don't want to. So those are things to practice with. It's great to have those things happen again under the Zen roof, under the Zen tent, and I think, I really do think, what thinking back on it, it what it does is the way through that for me is to drop deeper. It's a time, something I can use to drop deeper into no desire, into the world of no desire. Oh, I thought I had that world all buttoned up. No, I didn't. The same, you know, if I see somebody on the other side, on the anger, hatred side — hatred is such a strong word — but if I see somebody who I have some negative feeling about, you know, we live on an island, most of us, and you know, you're going to see somebody at Thriftway where, oh, it's a little awkward. What do you do? There it is. There's a little bit of unease that comes up. Can we drop deeper into our Buddha nature? And let, the way I see it, is let that take the lead. Just walk on. Just walk ahead. Say hello. Let that take the lead. Those are things we can practice with, to be sure. So though they come up over and over, I think over time we can transform these kleshas. Huineng says that we should, in his piece, he says we should get rid of the delusions in our own mind. And that's the second one. And Torre says cut off the roots. And cut off is a common translation of it. But there are other translations too. And I took this one that I found, transform, which is a little bit of an outlier. But I think cut off can give you the wrong impression. It can give you the feeling that our job is to cut them off for good. Mm-hmm. And they keep coming up, these desires, these cravings. And though I do actually think that it is our job to give them up completely, you could say cut them off, which is to say, when doing zazen, to get that feeling of giving up desire altogether, giving up attraction and aversion 100%. that's only temporary. And you can get the idea, it's a big mistake in Buddhism to think that those temporary things should be permanent. So that's why I like transform, because I think over time, our real job is to transform these things. To work with them, and to transform them and to transform ourselves into someone who has likes and dislikes. But that those likes and dislikes are not a matter of good and evil instinctively. That they, someone who can be clear and not fixated or stuck. And someone for whom greed and hatred come up less often, I think, and someone who has the means to work with them. And someone who realizes, you know, my ignorance, but am trying to understand. Finally, Dai Di says that to do the vow number one, the first vow, you need to do the other vows. You need to do the second vow. To realize such a great ideal, number two, to realize such a great ideal, I need to first become free from wild fancies and sticky attachments and attain genuine freedom and peace of heart. If we can become becoming free from these attachments, we can have peace and be free. And I think that can help us to lead us to liberate others as well. The first vow comes first, as I said, because it puts a big wide frame on the matter. But it's not, we shouldn't think that our job is to willy-nilly leap into liberating everybody. The next three are the tools that we need to do that liberation and to do it properly, to do it in a healthy way, to do it smart, not just to run out there and get burned out by liberating everybody. We have to take care of this practice as well. We have to take care of ourselves in this way. To strengthen ourselves, to make us wiser and more compassionate. I remember some family members, you know, asking me, what are you doing up there on Mount Baldy? How are you helping people? And I said, well, we help people who come, you know, we serve them. We do that. And that's very true, actually. I did a lot of that, helping people through, helping people understand themselves. But in another way, and we also helped with the water system, but in another way, I told him, I'm training. I'm getting ready. Getting ready to help in the right way. That's what we're doing here, I think. And so, Dai Di says, genuine freedom and peace of heart. I like the way he puts things. Freedom to take butter or not take butter. To engage with someone or not. Big enough, you know, to do either. Big enough to meet all kinds of situations freely. All that's practice. Here, today, we can do this no desire practice. I want to ask you to do that. To try to find a place within yourself that doesn't have any will, that doesn't have any desire. Drop into it, where there's no good or bad. And keep at it. Keep coming back over and over again, deeper and deeper, if you can. That's our practice. That's what leads us to the land of nirvana, leads us to understand that we have a Buddha in all of those realms, and leads us to liberate others.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.